Good evening. It is Monday, November 4th, 2019. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon, and for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. Well, Mick Mulvaney, his allies try to stonewall the Democrats' impeachment inquiry. Russell Vaught, a Mulvaney protege who leads the White House Office of Management and Budget, intends a concerted defiance of congressional subpoenas in the coming days, and two of his subordinates will follow suit, simultaneously proving their loyalty to the president and creating a potentially critical firewall regarding the alleged use of foreign aid to elicit political favors from a U.S. ally. All of this while the House investigators release transcripts of closed-door testimony. House impeachment investigators began moving witness testimony into the open for the first time today, releasing transcripts of private questioning taken last month when the former United States Ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, and a top diplomat who advised Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, Michael McKinley. And what's really interesting to me, appeals court rules President Trump must turn over 8 years of tax returns. A federal appeals panel said today that President Trump's accounting firm must turn over 8 years of his personal and corporate tax returns to Manhattan prosecutors. The appeals court said the president's accounting firm, not Mr. Trump himself, was subpoenaed for the documents, so it did not matter whether presidents have immunity. Whew! There's a lot to digest here. So for insight, let's turn to my first guest. He's an investigative reporter and founder of This Can't Be Happening, Dave Lindorf. Dave, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Hi, thanks for having me.
First, let me start with the last story. Appeals court rules Trump must turn over 8 years of tax returns. Now, I understand that the tax returns are not likely to be handed over anytime soon. Trump has fought vigorously to shield his financial records, and the case appears now headed to the Supreme Court. But the three-judge appeals panel, they didn't take a position on the president's biggest argument, and that was that he's immune from criminal investigation. A lower court called that argument repugnant to the nation's governmental structure and constitutional values. Your thoughts on the appeals court saying to the president, no, you don't have the coverage that you think you do?
Yeah, well, I think it's not a surprise. I mean, the notion that a president can shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and not be indicted is should appall everybody and is almost certainly not true. I mean, we haven't had a president do that. We've had them shoot a lot of people by, you know, especially since Obama, with on orders of the president.
but, right.
You know, they're not pulling the trigger themselves on the street and randomly shooting people. So I think that it's pretty clear that presidents are subject to prosecution. And certainly, you know, the second question is even if they can't be indicted, which, you know, makes a certain amount of sense, they're running the country, you know, you should probably get them out of office before you indict them, or whether by resignation or removal by the Senate. But you don't want to, like, just dog them endlessly in a trial. That could probably wait until after they're out of office. But you can investigate them, and that has already been demonstrated with, you know, prior impeachments. Nixon, who was in the middle of a very big war, and Congress went ahead and investigated him. And, you know, Clinton had myriad things going on internationally, and, you know, he was investigated up the kazoo and even forced to testify. So, you know, the notion that presidents can't be investigated is absurd on its face.
There are two points to what you've just brought up that I'd like to just unpack a little bit more. One is there seems to be a bit of inconsistency here on the part of the president, I know that's shocking, but yes, it's true, in attempting to block the subpoena for his financial records, his attorneys argued that the criminal investigation of the president was unconstitutional. They asserted that presidents have such unique power and responsibility that they can't be subjected to the burden of investigations, especially from local prosecutors who may use the criminal process for political gain. They pointed to the impeachment process as the correct way to address any potential wrongdoing by a president. Well, Dave, isn't there an impeachment inquiry underway right now? And I think that the president is saying that that's unconstitutional.
Yeah, exactly. And as Mulvaney is doing, trying to say that they don't have to comply with subpoenas from the impeachment committee or from Congress in general. So, yeah, it is a circular argument. It doesn't hold up. It contradicts itself. One of the things I had said earlier was I didn't understand why, other than the optics of it, why Pelosi, who is no friend of mine because she destroyed the sales of my book on impeachment back in 2006.
You and John Conyers as well, because she killed his as well. Well, go ahead.
She said that, you know, they didn't need to do a House vote authorizing an impeachment panel. And, you know, the truth is that an impeachment panel is an entity in the Constitution that gives it a special power. And because impeachment is specifically described in the Constitution, and I would argue that even the Supreme Court, as it is today constituted, you know, with a majority of constitutionalist, you know, literal constitutionalists from Roberts to Kavanaugh.
When it works for their convenience, when it serves their interest, they are.
Well, yes, but that's what they call themselves.
Right.
And they,
that's,
you know,
my point.
To the extent that there's any belief behind that, and I think in some of their cases there probably is, that they're going to side with the Constitution on this and say that, you know, an impeachment panel has special powers to investigate a president once there's been a vote. And once the Judiciary Committee is impaneled ultimately as the impeachment panel, and what they did with this last resolution was they actually empowered a number of committees that have been investigating the president as an impeachment panel.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, you know, the Intelligence Committee and several other committees. So that means that, you know, the Supreme Court is unlikely to uphold the notion that a president can ignore those subpoenas or that his staff can refuse to testify. So, yes, it's going to take time. It's all going to go up to the Supreme Court. But we only need, you know, you sort of know where the liberal justices are going to stand on this. And so there's four of them. And you only need one of the constitutionalist judges to say, you know, the Constitution is pretty clear here.
And it might be Roberts. Of all people, it might just wind up being Roberts.
I would guess it would be Roberts because he's still trying to recover from the scummy thing that he did in stopping the Florida vote counting.
Right.
And that was so blatantly political. Not grounded in states' rights or in, you know, any kind of sanctified right-wing vision of the Constitution. It was just politics. Let's get this guy elected president, and principle be damned. So he's trying to live that down because he's got his legacy to think of as the Chief Justice. So it's hard for me to imagine him upholding the president's ability to withstand, you know, and have his staff withstand subpoenas from an impeachment panel.
And to that point, one of the arguments in terms of the president's immunity claim came based upon his statement that he can stand on Fifth Avenue and shoot anybody without being hurt politically.
Yeah, I can't believe they actually said that in court.
Judge Danny Chin asked the president's attorney, Consovoy, about the potential effect of the president's immunity claim in such a hypothetical situation? Quote, local authorities couldn't investigate, end quote, the judge asked, adding, nothing could be done? That's your position? And now when a judge says that to you, I believe that that's a very leading question, trying to get you to understand, do you understand how stupid what it is you're saying to me is? And Consovoy says, that's correct, Your Honor.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. Golly!
No, Trump has not had a terrific record on hiring lawyers, if you've noticed. I mean, anybody who'd hire Giuliani as his lawyer is really, his judgment is questionable. But, you know, the other thing that I would say is that I've been thinking about this a bit. I just did a piece on it. I was saying that I thought that the rush to impeachment that Democrats seem to be on right now, including Pelosi, you know, let's impeach on this and let's go and get it over with, are crazy because, you know, the chances of Trump going down on the Ukraine thing, I think, in the Senate are maybe marginally better than zero.
Right, right.
And so what are you going to do? You're going to have your impeachment. You're going to get the vote in the House, probably largely on partisan lines, if not totally partisan. And then it's going to go to the Senate, and then it's going to get tanked by the Republican vote, which will, you know, probably they might not even get 50 senators. So it might be a total flop. And then Trump will spend the rest of the election year running around saying he was found innocent by the Senate. He'll say, I've been exonerated by the Senate. That's the word he'll use, and innocent he'll use. And then he'll attack Democrats for, you know, continuing to harass him and stop him from governing for political reasons. And why would Democrats want that when the alternative is to have impeachment run, you know, right out through, you know, maybe September and embarrass him with more and more investigations into his criminal behavior?
Now, that's my question. I asked this about 3 or 4 guests last week. I'm glad you brought that up. Following that logic, and I agree, everything that you've said will most likely be the outcome. The standard assessment is that that's what's going to happen. The Senate will find him not guilty. He'll run around saying, I've been exonerated. They came after me for political reasons. And people are saying that's why Pelosi should not have gone with impeachment, because it's going to fail and it's going to put
wrong,
it's going to
wrong. That's the wrong conclusion.
Right. So here's my question to you. Is it possible that even if the Senate finds the president not guilty, that the damage from the testimony, as the Democrats are now starting to release the testimony, will that be so damaging that the impeachment vote outcome is almost irrelevant?
That's a possibility. It remains to be seen what that testimony is.
Sure.
But, you know, if it's so venal and so awful that even people that voted for Trump look at it and say, "Ugh, you know, this is horrible." You know, that's possible. And I don't discount that possibility, but I still would say that the better bet tactically for Democrats would be to go with, you know, I mean, now their best bet would be to get his tax returns out in the public, because this guy's been a shyster for as long as he's been an adult.
Right.
Probably before then too, you know?
Right.
So, I mean, I spent 12 years of my life in New York City as a journalist, and, you know, and among the things I reported on was Donald Trump. It was just, you know, the guy hung out with mobsters. He was basically a launderer for mob money in his real estate, and he hired mobsters to do his construction work.
His mentor was counsel for mobsters.
And his His mentor, Roy Cohn, was a counsel for the mob, and his tactics are mob tactics. And all of this would come out, you know, if they start investigating him. His violation even of the Equal Rights Clause with
right.
regard to housing.
Fair housing,
courts.
Right.
They can drag, you know, they can get everything.
But you know what, Dave? None of that, that's not new information, though.
No, but the details aren't there.
Well,
you know,
in terms of his fair housing violations, in terms of the contractors, the Taj Mahal and other of his resorts that have, some of them have gone bankrupt because he failed to pay them. All of that stuff, that's not new.
No, it's not new, but it hasn't been. You know, what killed Nixon was the testimony and all the investigations, including into issues that didn't make it to the point of being approved as articles of impeachment. There were five or six articles of impeachment that were investigated for in
right.
the hearings on Nixon, which went on and on for months, at least like 4 months or more. And there were investigations prior to the actual impeachment panel, as there are now.
Right.
So, you know, those hearings were gripping. They were appalling. It was good television people wanted to watch. They heard incredible testimony from people like James Dean.
Right.
You know.
Let me ask you this, because we got to wrap up. Adam Schiff is starting to release testimony from the hearings.
Yeah.
I see the Democrats could very well, they have to be very, very careful here so that they don't fall into the same trap that they fell into with the so-called transcript of the Ukrainian call. They were telling us that the quid pro quo is right there in black and white. All you have to do is read the so-called transcript, which was really an accounting, not a transcript.
Yeah.
But it wasn't as clear as they were telling us it was.
Right. They overstayed. They
way oversold it. And so if they aren't careful, and if they don't lead people directly to where they believe people need to be with these transcripts, if they just put them out there and let people read them for themselves, A, it's going to be a snoozer because nobody wants to sit there and read that stuff. And B, I have yet to hear that anybody has provided the smoking gun to support the allegation.
Well, I think it's pretty much there, but what I would question is why. See, part of the problem is that we're dealing with a intelligence committee that's not used to doing public hearings,
mm-hmm.
and the other things that they could be doing hearings on, like the taxes, are open. That's not national security. You just have the people on there talking. And
right.
and what the American people need to see is the actual people talking. If we had instead of the transcripts right now, if we had the televised testimony
right.
of these people, you know, the
good point.
Get the whistleblower on and blank out his face or something,
right.
but let him talk, you know, listen to his voice. People like to judge the veracity of things that people say
for themselves,
by hearing their voice and
right.
looking at their body motion and everything, you know, all of that. And that's what we need to see. So they need to get this hearing to the point where they're putting these schmucks on the stand, you know, Mulvaney, geez, put them on the stand, you know, and televise it. Let everybody see it.
And final point here. Now the president is calling for the identity of the whistleblower to be made public. He's asked for copies of witness statements so he can decide how to criticize them. I mean, he's really operating here as though he's at Trump Incorporated instead of operating as the leader of the United States government.
Yeah, well, he's floundering a bit. I mean, I don't think he has a real strategy, but I would say that, you know, this whole thing about the whistleblower's identity, the whistleblower is irrelevant at this point.
Right.
He was actually not a witness. He steered people to witnesses, and the witnesses have already come out and basically confirmed what he said. So the fact that he might be an Obama guy or something and, you know, a Trump hater is irrelevant at this point because he's been backed up by people who aren't, people who are conservatives, soldiers, you know, credible ambassadors and stuff. So, you know, that's an old story now. Trump's like wasting time worrying about this whistleblower.
Dave Lindorf, founder of This Can't Be Happening, thanks for your time. Greatly appreciate your contribution to The Critical Hour.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Thanks, Dave. All right, folks, you're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. In Chile, there's a revolt against neoliberalism that corporate American media is refusing to cover. Quote, "We are at war with a powerful, relentless enemy that respects nothing nor anyone," end quote. That, according to Chilean President Sebastián Piñera, during a speech to the nation deliberately echoing the infamous catchphrase of fascist military dictator Augusto Pinochet. The quote-unquote enemy he was referring to were Chilean citizens, more than 1 million of them taking to the streets Friday afternoon in a revolt against the neoliberal system that he has implemented against their will, and the citizens are demanding his resignation. This, according to Alan McLeod in his Mint Press article. How are these neoliberal politicians taking hold in carrying the day? For insight into this, we turn to my next guest. He is a co-founder of Black Alliance for Peace and former vice presidential nominee for the Green Party. He is Ajamu Baraka. Brother Baraka, welcome back to The Critical Hour.
It's my pleasure to be with you once again.
This whole discussion about neoliberalism, we've seen this in Greece. We've seen this in Italy. We're now seeing this in Chile. Talk about this issue. First of all, explain what it is, because a lot of people hear the term, but they don't really understand neoliberal. It almost sounds like an oxymoron.
Well, you're absolutely right, and that's why it's important for us to always attach the other element to this. And when we talk about neoliberalism, we have to attach the word capital or capitalism. What we have is a return to the original ideal of capitalism, a so-called free market with a reduction in the activity of the state, a relentless assault on the ability of the peoples to organize themselves to resist the capitalist exploitation. And this neoliberal term was really applied beginning, in fact, in Chile in 1973, when the U.S. helped to engineer a coup that eliminated the socialist president of Allende in that country, and they imposed this new model of capitalism on the Chilean people, and that model became the model that they began to use with increased frequency throughout the 1980s and into the 1990s. So, you know, the consequence of all of this has been that the people who have been subjected to these neoliberal policies have, after almost four decades of these policies, engaged in now what appears to be a general revolt against the consequences of neoliberal policies, which means austerity, the reduction in state services, the stagnation and sometimes reduction in wages, the selling off of public assets, you know, environmental degradation, the selling of critical resources like water. So the people are finally, it appears, across the globe, in open revolt against these policies.
You know, one thing I think is important for people to understand as they try to come to grips with the terminology is that these terms aren't static. They evolve and change over time. For example, the term conservatism. We can go back to the French Revolution and look at as the basis of the French Revolution, folks were becoming conservative because they wanted to conserve the original Catholic ideas that France was based upon it at the time of the French Revolution. These terms, they evolve and change over time as history and as economies develop and change over time.
Exactly. And right now we're in one of those critical moments in history where all meaning is really contested. These terms are now contested because their meanings have, in fact, been transformed. So, for example, liberals today or neoliberals can be seen as the conservatives of today because they are trying to preserve a system of capitalist production that is clearly in contradiction to the needs of the vast majority of the people in this country and globally. And so, you know, what today constitutes liberalism? What constitutes conservatism? What does it mean to be left or to the right? All of these terms and labels are in flux right now and are contested.
Many people would look at, for example, Nancy Pelosi, and people would look at Chuck Schumer as Democrats and say, wait a minute, how can they be backing the play in Venezuela? How can they be backing the overthrow of Maduro? How can, you know, I thought Democrats were supposed to be the party of peace, not hawks. But when you throw in the military-industrial complex, when you throw in who's funding, who's actually underwriting these parties, and you find that they're basically getting their money from many of the same funding sources, the articulation of their allegiances may be a bit different, but the underlying premises upon which they are based are the same.
And you know, Dr. Leon, the reason for that is that there is an ideological convergence, an ideological unity, if you will. Pelosi and Schumer and all of those elements are ideologically committed to the neoliberal project. And that's why they have not spoken out aggressively about what is unfolding in Chile. As a matter of fact, your listeners probably know that if they were looking for any information in the mainstream press on Chile, they're not going to find it. That's why they have to come to shows like yourself, because these neoliberals who are aligned with the interests of the corporations and the corporate media, they don't want the people to know what is unfolding in Chile and unfolding in Haiti and in Ecuador and across the Americas in other parts of the world. They don't want people to understand that the neoliberal idea is not only contested, but has been rejected by people around the world. So, you know, the coverage of this has been sparse, but the consequence of what is unfolding in Chile is really rocking the entire Americas region.
So people listening to you and I talking will say, well, wait a minute. So it's happening in Chile, but that's Chile. Who cares? Why should I care in Cleveland? Why should I care in Detroit or Washington, D.C.? And as we talk about neoliberal, and one of the elements that you defined was privatization of public resources, in this country, one of the names that immediately pops into my head is Betsy DeVos, the Secretary of Education, and how her whole mission is to privatize public education. Explain to the audience what privatization of public education means.
Well, yeah, I would talk about that and talk about privatization of other elements of the government or the state.
Sure.
Basically, it means that the capital has seen education as a $53 billion potential market. And so they have been for the last more than a decade attempting to use their influence over the government, over the state, to carve out pieces of the educational sector to the private sector. So you have this expansion of private schools and charter schools and turning over public education to the private sector. Because they have been successful in implanting the notion, the idea, that if it's the private sector, it could be done better. And so the students are seen as clients, and the private companies are seen as deliverers of services. This is all part of the neoliberal ideological project. And it's important, I'm glad you raised that question, because what we have in the U.S. and the relevance of people in Detroit and other places with what's happening in Chile, in Haiti, and throughout the Americas is that austerity, neoliberal austerity, is also alive and well in the U.S., except that, again, we don't call it that in the U.S. The corporate media does not refer to these privatization schemes as austerity. They don't talk about the fact that vital social services have been eliminated by the state. They don't remind the people, unless it's Bernie Sanders, to talk about that wages have stagnated over the last 40 years. You know, they don't talk about the amount of resources of being transferred to the military to maintain the hegemony of capital in the U.S. All of these things are linked. The repression in the U.S., the repression that these states like in Chile are applying against their own citizens in that country, are all related, because they all are trying to maintain this global capitalist system. That's the connection between Chile and Detroit and Atlanta and Chicago.
There's also another element of this, which is deregulation. And along with privatization and the using of your public tax dollars to underwrite the ventures of private corporations under the pretext of providing public services, then you throw into that deregulation, which means the government is not going to oversee what's being done here nearly to the degree that it has. So now the private sector has freer rein. And one of the things that I say to people about deregulation, Ajamu, is those who want to deregulate always talk about it on the side of the corporate interest and cutting red tape, and it's just too hard to get products to market. But what they don't ever talk about is the consumer on the other side of that equation, whose health is being protected, whose water is being protected, whose air quality is being protected, whose home may not burn down because of a forest fire because of regulation. They don't talk about the public benefit side. They always talk about the corporate interest side.
They do. And they don't talk about those realities when you have the state that is basically on the side of private capital and the consequences it has for the people. They don't talk about the fact that they are helping to prop up governments in Latin America and Africa and in Asia that are pursuing the same kinds of policies vis-a-vis their people. Because, again, they don't want those connections to be made. But what we're seeing in Chile and what we're seeing throughout the Americas and the parts now of Africa is a general exhaustion, a rejection of this approach. People are saying that, you know, if there's going to be a government, if there's going to be a state, it has to be on the side of the people and that capital. And that's why you have a million people in the streets in Chile. That's why you had a rebellion against neoliberal policies in Ecuador. That's why you're having a resistance to Bolsonaro in Brazil. And that's why you have the people hanging on in resistance in Venezuela. So this is a whole tide that's being turned now against capital. And the danger we have to be aware of is that because of this general uprising from the people, capital, using its state and its primary enforcer, the U.S. military, is primed to become more vicious and more violent in order to protect itself.
I'm glad you mentioned Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil, because he won handily his election with his homophobic, his racist rhetoric. Many people don't realize that it was Steve Bannon who was behind Bolsonaro, the same way Steve Bannon is behind Donald Trump. And the election of Bolsonaro was a reaction. It was a reaction the same way the election of Trump is a reaction. And now there's buyer's remorse in Brazil.
Well, you know, and Dr. Leon, the other issue that's really interesting and contradictory is that there's been some public opposition to Bolsonaro in Brazil. They talk about, correctly, that he represents right-wing forces, neo-fascist forces in that country. But to show you the ideological confusion, At the same time, some of these people who are critical of Bolsonaro, including many Democrats, would then turn around and support the Trump administration's attempt to put into power in Venezuela
right.
the same social forces.
Right.
Juan Guaido represents the same neo-fascist social forces. So it shows you the depth of the political confusion and why, you know, we've got to always be in a place like in your show to try to unpackage this confusion, because of that, we find ourselves supporting people whose interests are completely opposed to ours.
That's a very, very, very clear and fundamental point, Ajamu, is what do you stand for?
Mm-hmm.
What are you about? And if you are on the side of right, if you are on the side of the people, if you are on the side of clean water and the resources in a country being used to raise the standard of living of the people in the country, if you are for those very fundamental elements, then it's very hard to get confused over whether you stand for Bolsonaro or whether you are backing Nancy Pelosi's support of the overthrow of Maduro, because you answer those very 1 + 1 will always equal 2.
Exactly. And those kind of questions have to be raised within the U.S. because we're seeing this general uprising for people around the world, and in particular in our region when we're talking about the Americas. But the question is being raised by people around the world is, where are the people in the U.S.? At the center of empire, why aren't the people in the U.S. who are also being negatively impacted by neoliberal policies, why aren't they in the streets? And that's a very important question, because the people in Mexico have spoken out, and the people in Bolivia and in Argentina, I mean, they have reversed, you know, some of the inroads that were made by neoliberal capital in the Americas. But people are saying, why isn't that the U.S. population is standing up for its rights, calling on the U.S. state to protect their fundamental human rights? And that's a very important question that people have to begin to raise, and raise with some of these candidates, too, for example, who are running for national office.
You mentioned Bolivia. If you could just take a minute, Evo Morales, the first indigenous president of Bolivia, is up against Carlos Mesa. Explain why you threw Bolivia into the conversation.
Because Bolivia is one of the main progressive states in the Americas, and because Morales won the election, he's now being subjected to another attempt by the U.S. and right wing forces to undermine his presidency. But the people are fighting back, and they're reversing these attempts. So, you know, what we see in Bolivia is important. The Alberto Fernandez was elected in Argentina, which was a very important election. There is progress being made even in places like Colombia, where some of the right-wing forces have lost local elections. So, you know, the tide has turned back in the favor of the people. But again, one critical element that's missing is the pressure coming against the U.S. state internally from the people in the U.S. And that is something that people need to understand, that they have a responsibility to, in fact, address, that it is their government, their state, that's responsible for this, the suffering and the repression that many, many people are facing around the world. And is indefensible for people to allow themselves to be corrupted to the point of non-opposition while their state is involved in all of this criminal activity throughout the planet.
And to the point and final point here, and I'll ask you to respond to this, and then I'll let you go. And thank you so much for being so generous with your time today. You talk about where are the voices of the electorate or the people in the United States? Well, when Lockheed Martin is controlling what you hear over the airwaves, when General Electric is controlling what you hear over the airwaves, when Archer's Daniel Midland is controlling what you hear over the airwaves, the message is going to be skewed, and the message is not going to be in the direction of the best interest of the people in this country.
Exactly. And it's amazing and really a testament to the people in the U.S. that with all of this constant propaganda that there's still significant elements of the population that are opposed to war and militarism, that young people are almost to 70% are willing to take a serious look at socialism. You know, the ruling class is in trouble, and they know that. And that's why they are moving in the way that they are moving, not only in Latin America and parts of Africa, but also in the U.S., trying to undermine and constrict democracy even further. So we have a lot of work to do, but I think many of us are optimistic that the tide is, in fact, turning and that we can, in fact, make some real progress in this country and really around the world.
Ajamu Baraka, co-founder of Black Alliance for Peace. As always, thank you so much for your time. Greatly appreciate your work and your contribution to the Critical Hour.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. All right, folks, you're tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Well, it's been 40 years since the Greensboro Massacre, and people are still discussing the events and how to keep history from repeating itself again. On the morning of November 3rd, 1979, a mixed group of community activists assembled by the Communist Workers' Party were preparing to march against the Ku Klux Klan through the streets of Greensboro, North Carolina. There, they were confronted by a caravan of Klansmen and neo-Nazis who opened fire on the group, killing five and wounding several others. The gunmen didn't act alone, and they were eventually acquitted by all white juries. The gang of Klansmen and Nazis murdered five in broad daylight. This was the Greensboro Massacre. Many believe the massacre that spawned the alt-right. What was this? How are its repercussions being felt today? Why is this not getting more national coverage? For insight into this, we turn to my next guest. He is a member of the Black Alliance for Peace and Pan-African Community Action, NETFA Freeman. NETFA, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Thank you, as always, for having me. It's always an honor and a pleasure.
So your thoughts on this and where we are today?
Man, that's a broad question. So right now, I can't really help but think about a lot of the recent things that are taking place in 40 years later. Like, for example, the Trump administration's announcing a surge, what they call the surge. So increasing support for the militarization of police in the United States, with all the veiled and coded language talking about it in such a way which we know that it really is intended for the what they call the criminals and the immigrants and whatnot, which really mean black people and indigenous people who are on the other side of the border they created. And also things like the conflict or the controversy around this thin blue line thing, and I remember the and so then they were talking about the court system and the police not doing anything about it. And now we're seeing the same thing, relatively speaking, but only in more veiled and a more veiled way. So like the Charlottesville,
right,
the thing that just recently happened. And then even when the alt-right came here to Washington, D.C., people, if they haven't seen the footage, maybe it wasn't covered in that way, but you could see fist bumps with the police, you know, and the alt-right, you know, them bumping fists and, you know, in solidarity and support of each other. And the fact that right now, since then, the FBI, and I think we've talked about it on your show before, have been able to investigate and discover that white supremacists, organized white supremacists, have infiltrated law enforcement at every level, which to me also, not to me, but it means, according to their report, the counterterrorism division of the FBI includes the FBI itself, includes the court system, includes all the, you know, the police force. And so right now we're seeing in this time of where neoliberalism is the order of the day and austerity, everything that's anti-people, and those who think that they're entitled to something of a quote-unquote American dream just by virtue of them being white.
Birthright.
right, exactly, mm-hmm. at birthright, then they're in desperation, and then they're seeing everything but the real cause of their suffering as being people who are the most disenfranchised. And so instead of it, them having a systemic analysis and looking for the, you know, and then also it brings back, because with the Greensboro massacre, it was about communists and socialists who were calling for them to, you know, and that now you even see the system, everyone talk disparaging what they see as a popular embracing of socialism, disparaging communism. Donald Trump makes pronouncements about it publicly, and even you have Democratic candidates disparaging it, or at least trying to talk about it disparagingly because of the candidates like Bernie Sanders and mm-hmm. them being avowed socialist or claiming to be socialist, then they want to make sure they separate themselves from that. And so right now we're seeing a system that's reacting to the to basically the grassroots people and the will of the people. Polls are saying, they just had a poll that was actually, ironically enough, put out by anti-communists, you know, that discover, you know about it, where they discovered that young people, younger generation of millennials, are favorable to having a common, was to vote for a communist candidate and are favorable to socialism as an ideal. And they expected something else. And now they try to turn around and say the results were a result of, was the people having historical amnesia or something like that, as if communism ever really did anything to anybody here. And so it's very interesting. I think it's a result of desperation. I mean, that's what makes me, what I think of when you think about the anniversary of the Greensboro massacre and what it means for today and what we're seeing today. It's very interesting. And the reason why, one of the parts of the in your opening was talking about why the media is not mm-hmm. really covering certain things. And I think it's for what some of the stuff I said. One, the media are, most of the major media, all of the major media in this country, or the most popular, are corporations themselves, are capitalists themselves, are beholden to the interests and the paradigm of neoliberalism and capitalism, and they can't really afford, you know, they're the ones complicit, or actually they're corporations. So in a lot of ways, the CEOs and shareholders are, you know, really have control over the government versus the other way around. But there's this incestuous or symbiotic relationship between the system and the media, where they have to downplay any sentiments around socialism and communism, any sentiments that expose this as a white supremacist settler colonial project, an extension really of Western Europe, because that's really what, you know, think about it, that everything is around that. NATO, what us in the Black Alliance for Peace refer to as the US-EU-NATO axis of domination, which is not just trying to dominate, and which doesn't just fulfill itself by dominating this country or in the land here, but also the planet. And so they really can't, the media can't cover this in any kind of way that helps people think about things any more critically, that actually exposes some of the real. And I'll say this, and I'll let you maybe go, is that yesterday we were watching me and my mother were watching the news about the Thin Blue Line mm-hmm. thing, where the police department had put this flag or replica, that somebody gave them a replica of a flag with the Thin Blue Line in it, and they put it in the yard and they were made to take it off. I can't remember where this state was, the governor or whoever made them remove it. And there was a whole controversy about that. And then they, you know, say, oh, the Red Blue Line, you know, it's the same. And, you know, she couldn't understand what it was about.
It was Montgomery County. It was Montgomery County, Maryland.
That's right. It was Montgomery County, Maryland. Now I'm remembering. But it's because the media didn't give the fill in the context of the significance of the Thin Blue Line and its relationship to the Blue Lives Matter racist counter response to the Black Lives Matter and the police, you know, not wanting us. We're not supposed to have the nerve to demonstrate against them killing us with impunity, and how widespread that is. So they created the Blue Lives Matter, and that Thin Blue Line is part that symbol, and that what that represents has been used in, and they use it to raise it up. So it's separate from the Red Blue Line, which is the fire department, and the people don't have as, you know, don't have problems, right, obviously, with firefighters trying to, you know, but they make it sound like, well, people are, you know, making a distinction that's unfair, which is, you know, obviously not. Without the context, we won't understand that it's not unfair.
A couple of things. One, the lack of coverage from the so-called left-leaning elements of our media, MSNBC and so on and so forth, the fact that they're not discussing this and tying what happened in 1979 to what's going on right now. To me, the vacuous nature of all of that dialogue, to me, speaks volumes. But and then to your point about when people really understand who it was that was organizing down in Greensboro,
right.
They were intellectuals, they were Maoists, they were communists, they were people with from Harvard and from Duke University that were coming into the community to hold this rally. And then you have a caravan with Nazis and Klansmen. And there are those who study those groups that would say, well, wait a minute, they're diametrically opposed, except that they are all aligned with white supremacist thinking.
Right.
So, you know, they can all find common ground when it comes to them versus us. Then the other ideological issues fall by the wayside. But your thoughts about this that I just laid out.
Well, what it does, and I mean, you pretty much, I guess, to pull out, make it more explicit, is that what the media can't allow us to do, and it's really about keeping the critical thinking down. I think sometimes they just have to report stuff because then it'd be too obvious if they didn't report it.
Mm-hmm.
But if they have to report it in a way that sanitizes us from being able to understand. Now, when we look at that history, we're seeing, because communism and socialism is always maligned, it's always made, and they always talk about the evils of the massacres and the different supposed allegedly horrible things, but some things were not so good in terms of those who embraced their so-called communists and whatnot, but they weren't reflective of it as an ideological thing or as a movement. But we're always taught here in the U.S. that they're bombarded with, oh, that's the extremist, that's the, you know, the oppressive thing. But when you look at the Greensboro Massacre history, then that puts things in a completely different reality with Nazis and the Klans and really the police and the system, which gave them impunity on one side. And then you have, if you give the historical context, like you gave a little bit of, the organizers of socialism, communism, and a multiracial group organizing in the poor communities and trying to give empowerment and rights and sustenance to people in the poor, then everything becomes a little more clear in a way that's threatening to the status quo.
So with that, there are those who believe that this was the beginning of the Unite the Right. And again, you've got neo-Nazis, you've got Klansmen, and that takes us right up to Charlottesville and how many of those who subscribe to those ideologies now feel emboldened by the hyperbolic rhetoric of the current administration. And I underscore hyperbolic rhetoric because it's not that the policies have changed. It's just that the articulation of them has become much clearer.
Mm-hmm. And then also what emboldens them, one is there's a desperation underlining all of it because the system is just that squeeze, that material conditions that people feel, and that's how they deal with it. But then also another part that emboldens them is the silence on the part of the so-called adversaries of theirs, like the Democratic Party. You don't hear any of the candidates talking about this. And they also always, when they do to deal with it, like the Blue Lives Matter bill, which is supposed to support the police and makes it a hate crime to assault a police officer, right?
Mm-hmm.
Those kind of things show the bipartisan nature of it. So that's another reason why they feel emboldened. They know they're not going to be denounced by other politicians.
Now, let me say to you real quick, because there are those who would say, well, of course, assaulting a police officer should be a crime. But what you have to do is read the bill and understand what assault, how assault is defined. And any level of resistance or questioning police officer could result in your traffic ticket becoming a felony.
That's right. Very good clarity.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Netfa. Let me get out and just reiterate this point. What people need to understand is that the morning of November 3rd, 1979, this happened in broad daylight.
Daylight.
That none of the Klansmen nor the Nazis were convicted. Now, there was a civil suit that was brought 6 years later, and some individuals were found responsible. But in terms of the criminal charges, no one was convicted. Broad daylight. And it wasn't as though they didn't have enough witnesses.
That's another reason they can't talk about it.
The more things change, the more they stay the same. Netfa Freeman, man, thank you so much for your time. Got to get out of here. Look forward to having you back.
Oh, thank you so much.
Hey, man, thank you. All right, folks, you've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.